Okay, let me start by thanking the organizers for asking me to give this talk in this long session. And I'll talk from the perspective of a condensed matter theorist. I mean, I started doing this kind of optical lattice physics roughly 5 years ago because the postdocs in the group, who are all condensed matter theorists, were very eager to do physics of optical lattices because, for a reason that was discussed early in the morning by David Gross and Bill Phillips, condensed matter physics, condensed matter theory, and optical lattice physics were coming together very fast, and postdocs wanted to do it, so we started doing it. Then we had this subject, then we had this institute, JQI, that Bill talked about 4 years ago, which imposed, which brought in more postdocs who want to do optical lattice physics. Now, I have a random collection of buzzwords or titles from condensed matter physics that I'm going to throw in first. One-dimensional Fermi gas, strongly interacting one-dimensional gases, ferromagnetic Fermi gas, spin fluctuation, spin orbit coupling, spin transport, non-abelian gauge fields, Mott insulator, topological state of matter, topological phases, triangular and hexagonal lattices, spin models, super solidity, two-dimensional Bose gases, disorder insulators, dirty bosons, superconductivity, magnetism, quantum critical behavior, universality scale invariance. So this looks like a bunch of topics I have taken from like 10 different condensed matter theory or condensed matter physics conferences. Actually, these are just random collections from the titles of this conference. If you go back, each of these expressions arise in some talks of this conference, which is pretty astonishing if you think about it. Because certainly 12 years ago, David Gross alluded to 12 years ago, in a cold atom conference, if somebody said there will be huge number of titles which will be, you know, items which we discuss in condensed matter physics every day and have been discussing for the last 50 years, that would be, inconceivable. So, I mean, I find this unbelievably impressive that in a conference on cold atoms, we have in the titles words which are, you know, stock words of condensed matter theorists in their everyday physics. And that tells you how close these two subjects have come. So probably perspectives of a condensed matter theorist is not probably warranted. So of course you have lots of discoveries in cold atom optical lattice physics, which are related to condensed matter physics, and they have been alluded to today also, Bose-Einstein condensation, degenerate Fermi gas. We just heard an absolutely beautiful talk on that. Now, of course, we have a neutral degenerate Fermi system in condensed matter physics, which is also very, very pure, helium-3. And I do not know, there has been a lot of work connecting what we know in helium-3, which is a huge amount, with what we heard from Debbie Jin in the last talk. I think it probably is worthwhile to see in helium-3, usually Fermi liquid theory, and then you do many body theory. It's a strongly interacting system where the interaction is short range, and it may be worthwhile to go back and see how the helium-3 physics connects with what we heard today just a few minutes ago. Block bland, block oscillations, quasi-particles, polarons, superfluidity, BC-BCS crossover, bosonic and fermionic superfluidity, bosonic Mott-Hubbard model, fermionic Hubbard model, various complex lattices like double well lattices that Bill Phillips talked about, higher bands, SP bands, superfluid Mott insulator transition, which has been directly seen on atomic level thanks to these microscopes, Costa-Lewis-Thales transition, Anderson localization, Aubrey localization, Bose Fermi mixtures, possible FFL of Lays, block ferromagnetism, spinner condensation. So all these things have already been seen. And, you know, again, I chose only the items from the discoveries that I am familiar with in my role as a condensed matter theorist. I'm actually a pure dilettante when it comes to atomic physics. I do not know much atomic physics, but these are things I know, and they all show up in a big way in cold atom optical lattices. Again, a tremendous overlap between the interests of condensed matter theory and atomic physics. So, of course, if you look at the number of exotic quantum phases that have been predicted, all you have to do is go to ConMed archive. Every day some exotic phase is predicted. I contribute not every day, but probably every month to these predictions, because it's a laboratory where we condensed matter physicists feel that everything can be changed in exquisite control over system parameters and coupling strength because of this beauty of Feshbach resonance and the fact that by changing the laser strengths, one can change the hopping the kinetic energy, so you can change both potential energy and kinetic energy, and to leading order you basically have no intrinsic disorder. You can introduce disorder. This is like our ideal laboratory because of that. Okay, there are some problems. The system is actually inhomogeneous, and this is different from condensed matter. In condensed matter we have at least ensemble averaged spatial invariance, and this system's really high temperature systems. This is not emphasized often, although the temperature in absolute unit is very, very low. If you look at it in units of any dimensionless unit like Fermi temperature, you know, in metals, 10 to the power minus 6 in dimensionless unit of temperature is routinely achieved, right? If you do experiments at 10, 15, 20 millikelvin, you are 10 to the power minus 6. And in cold atom, we are talking about 0.1. And this is something that actually struck me right in the beginning, that people talk about low temperature, but really these systems are high temperature systems. And that's, again, an inconvenience for condensed matter theorists. But, you know, if you leave out some of these inconveniences, these are ideal systems, and the fact that the techniques, experimental techniques, are complementary to condensed matter physics is actually an advantage. It's not a disadvantage, because in condensed matter physics you already can do transport in metal superconductors. Here the fact we can look directly at the momentum distribution function is plus, it's not a minus. So that I see as a positive thing. So, you know, with that introduction, I decided to give a rather general introduction, because question may come up, what is a condensed matter theorist doing in this conference? So I'm going to give you four recent examples of theory that are done at Maryland in JQI, all very germane to the conference. There are other talks related to the topics I'm going to talk about. And I chose those four only because I happen to be involved in them. You know, if I were not lazy, then I could choose four topics from other people's work, which will be equally condensed matter-ish, but applied entirely in the context of cold atom physics, although the original idea may have arose because of our knowledge of condensed matter physics. The specific aspects we'll discuss are purely cold atom physics. So one will be the issue of Oberle localization. This is localization in an incommensurate potential. So this will be a non-interacting problem. So bosons or fermions do not matter. There is no interaction, just a quantum ground state problem for a non-interacting particle. And there are interesting questions that are still unsolved. We'll have several talks on this later in the session. And this is mainly John Biddle's work. Many of the John Biddle and Bean Wang are both in audience. So this is physics of Anderson localization. Then I'll talk about the problem of a spontaneous interlayer coherence, basically excitonic condensation, what we call excitonic condensation in condensed matter physics, in the context of a bilayer dipolar fermionic system. So this will be fermions with interaction only, no disorder. So this was just disorder, no interaction. This will be only interaction, fermions. This is neither fermions nor bosons, applies to both. This will be no disorder, just interaction. I'm going to kind of establish how a very interesting non-intuitive phase could appear in this system. The phase is so non-intuitive, so non-classical, it's kind of hard to describe it. Third problem is a problem goes back a very long time. It goes back to an absolutely seminal paper written by Matthew Fisher and his collaborators, I think in 1990, is the question of what happens when we interact in both systems and you introduce disorder in it. And this problem, of course, taken on its own life in the cold atom system, and we'll have a talk, I think, by Brian DiMarco, and theoretical talk on numerical work on this. I'll explain a recent paper of ours where we did some very simple, purely analytical work to understand it. This is the famous Dirac boson problem in condensed matter physics. And the fourth problem is also a very famous problem, is the problem of interacting Hofstadter spectrum of bosons in an artificial gauge field. So this is the problem of, you know, superfluidity in the incommensurate limit, or incommensurate vortex lattice physics, is the physics of what happens when you have bosons on a lattice and you apply a magnetic field which is incommensurate to the lattice. And what can you say about the superfluidity in this system? So you can see that my choice is guided entirely by its condensed matter theory appeal or condensed matter theory taste. But these things experimentally are much better done in this cold atom optical lattices. So this is the beauty of this subject. And to apply these theories to cold atom optical lattices, you cannot just take some condensed matter recipe and blindly apply it. You have to modify it, and you have to customize it for the specific kind of cold atom system. So I could have talked about other things. We have other subjects, but these are the four I hope to. And you know, I'll give you a flavor of each. So the first one is this basically one-dimensional localization problem is John Biddle. He's actually here right now as a graduate fellow. All the work I'll be talking about either came out in 2010 or unpublished, has not come out or has not even been submitted. So we all know that if you have a model of one-dimensional lattice where an electron or a quantum particle is just one particle, so it really doesn't matter, this Fermi-Fermilab boson, hopping around with nearest neighbor short-range hopping, and then you have disorder, then Anderson proved a theorem in 1958, absence of diffusion in a certain random lattices, that in one dimension all wave functions are localized for any potential strength. Now, a very closely related model, which is not as well known, is the model created by Aubry, a French mathematician, I think in 1980, where he showed that you do not really need disorder if you have an incommensurate potential. So for example, you have two potentials which are where the period is irrational with respect to each other. Then you have interesting localization physics also. But in both cases, so in Anderson case, in 1D, all states are localized. So you have no mobility edge. You have no energy which distinguishes localized states from extended states. So in some sense, it's one dimension, it's somewhat uninteresting. Only thing you can ask, okay, how does the localization length depend on disorder? But all states are localized, it's theoretically well established. In the Aubry problem, all wave functions are either localized or all wave functions are extended depending on the strength of the potential. If the potential is very strong, then all states are localized. If the potential is very weak and strong are precisely characterized, I'll show you, then all states are completely extended. Again, there is no energy dependence in your localization transition. So neither case has any energy dependent mobility edge. What I'll show you is that with slight modification, in fact, the modification is just that you relax the short-range hopping criterion, nearest neighbor hopping criterion, then you can have an experimentally testable counterexample. In fact, you can have a situation where you have a mobility edge in the problem and the states below the mobility edge are extended and above localized, okay? So this statement is exact theoretical statement, but they're much easier to study in cold atomic gases, as we will see in a session later in the week when you see beautiful experiments from Paris and from Florence discussing this localization of these both kinds. So let me set up the Aubry-André problem. So the classic problem is defined on a nearest neighbor lattice. So here is an electron hopping, nearest neighbor hopping, and then you have a potential. All you need is alpha some irrational. So if alpha is irrational, then this extra potential is incommensurate with respect to lattice because the unit is irrational. So you have the classic Aubry-André or Harper equation. And this problem was solved, and it was shown mathematically that there is a self-duality at nu is equal to v is equal to 2t. This strength of the potential, strength of the incommensurate potential, exactly equal to 2t. Basically, what happens is that at that point, this equation becomes identical in its Fourier space. So this is the point of self-duality, and since it's the state can neither be extended nor localized, so it's a Cantor-Sec spectrum, and that point is kind of a singular point, and all states for v larger than 2t, 2t1, are all states are localized, and for v less than 2t1, all states are extended. So this duality point determines localized extended set boundary. It does not allow any energy-dependent mobility edge. Now, how can we create this kind of state in a cold atom optical lattice? Well, you have two different lasers which are irrational with respect to each other. Now, of course, you have something like this. This is Schrodinger equation. This is not the tight binding equation. So you are not guaranteed to have nearest ever hopping. You know, this equation will have whatever hopping there is. Of course, if you take the limit of very deep primary lattice, then we could say it's essentially like a nearest neighbor hopping. It's not exactly nearest neighbor hopping, but essentially nearest neighbor hopping. So you have to remember, in real experimental system, you have to solve the Schrodinger equation, not an equivalent tight binding model, but in many cases, you can make your lattice such that it boils down to the equivalent tight binding model. So what we did, first, I'm just going to show you first numerical work. So you took this Schrodinger equation. Others have done it also. I'm just showing you our results, but other people have done it also. So what I'm showing you here is first a very deep lattice. In a deep lattice, what I'm showing you is called, this is a quantity called inverse participation ratio. Never mind what it is, it's some kind of composite quantity that you calculate in terms of the ground state wave function. So you calculate the ground state wave function exactly numerically by diagonalizing the system. And if you know the ground state wave function, then you can calculate this quantity, which depends on the fourth power of this ground state wave function, and some integral, which is called inverse participation ratio. On from, you know, 50 years work in condensed matter physics, we know this inverse participation ratio is perhaps the best single numerical guide to detect localization in numerical work. So what I'm showing you is, so here is a very deep lattice. So we have solved Schrodinger equation exactly in a very deep lattice. And you can see that all states here are extended for some value of V, okay? And then when V becomes larger, all states are localized. So basically this is verifying the fact that yes, you have one sharp point, this line, where for a deep lattice, solving a Schrodinger equation verifies Aubry-André transition that either all sets are localized, all sets are extended for all energies. This is all the eigenstates. It doesn't really matter as long as the primary lattice is very deep. But here is a situation where the primary lattice is not so deep. So this is what we saw first numerically. And as you can see now, where you are in eigenstate, so if you go to low eigenstate, the value of V over E1 is small. If you go to very high eigenstate, it has gone up. That means now what you are finding is energy-dependent localization. So just the exact solution of the Schrodinger equation with two potential, which are irrational with respect to each other, is indicating there is something interesting that is going on. So this motivated us to theoretically study an implicit short-range hopping model. So all we did is to take the original hopping, original Schrodinger equation, and instead of having just T1, just nearest neighbor hopping, we just said, let there be an exponential term connecting various neighbors. So we can connect T1 is the first term here, T2 falls off exponentially, T3 falls off exponentially. So it's an implicit short-range hopping. It's short-range, but it's not zero range. It's not just nearest neighbor. It turns out, so this is a generalization of Aubry-André problem. It turns out this problem can be analytically solved. Okay? So it's a non-zero hopping terms beyond the nearest neighbor term, and it's similar to Aubry-André model. This model also has a self-duality point, but the self-duality point now depends on the energy of your state. So it's an energy-dependent self-duality point. So let's show you, and the details are in this paper. So basically what we have to do is that this is an equation. So you have to introduce a quantity, because you solve it, then you know how to explain it very easily. If you introduce this quantity, Tn, and write another quantity, omega, then you can convert this equation to this equation, E plus some T, V cosine 2 pi alpha n omega squared Tn, and Tn now has all the hopping physics in it. And so this is the equation we want to, so this is now the model Schrodinger equation. The original equation now becomes this, and this is the equation we want to solve. It turns out this equation can be solved by basically doing a discrete Fourier transformation of the type Aubry introduced in 1980. If you introduce this transformation, then you can write Tn inverse in this form, then that equation can immediately be solved by writing it in this way, and then you find a point, this equation is the duality point. You can show that this equation, cosine hyperbolic of P, E plus T divided by V, solves the equation of this self-dual point. The difference with the case, the pure Aubry-André case, where your nearest neighbor hopping is that there was no E here. Now, you have a self-dual point, but the self-dual point now depends on energy, which means that you have energy-dependent mobility edge. So the boundary is an explicitly dependent energy, you have energy-dependent mobility edge. And this, if you take P to be infinity, since P is nothing other than how the exponential is falling off, if you take P to be infinity, then you immediately recover the Aubry-André condition, and E drops out. So we did numerical work. So we did numerical work to show how this thing actually behaves. So here is the spectrum for, let me just tell you the large P. At large P, you expect this line to be almost vertical, because that means these are extended states, these are localized states. So this is large V, this is small V. And what I'm showing is all the states. We have solved for all the states numerically, and I'm showing you whether the state is more extended or more localized or more extended. And what you can see is now, it explicitly depends on energy, but weakly. If you make P very small, that means you have many neighbors connected by hopping. Now the energy dependence is very, very strong. Okay? And this is the same thing shown differently. Okay, so you have mobility age, which now is explicit function of energy, and here are some examples of the actual state. So here is a this is for a fixed value of potential energy and t. Here is a state well below mobility age, completely localized. Here is a state above the mobility age, which is extended, and here is the state near the boundary, which is fractal, but in a finite system, to see the fractality, you have to do a lot of numerical work, which is probably not very relevant, because the experimental system will be finite also, and I think this Cantor set spectrum, you can probably see it, but I do not think that it's particularly interesting, because the system is finite. So, how do you map into the problem of two periods, the Schrödinger equation, the so-called bichromatic problem? Schrödinger equation is two incommensurate period, so you can just do an approximate mapping where you take this parameter P and put this to be this, you know, ratio of the two potentials, and we have done that in this paper, and we showed that when you solve the full Schrödinger equation, then you numerically solve the full Schrödinger equation, we found that quite amazingly, the results we got from the simple model, this simple model actually applied to the full Schrödinger equation quite well. I mean, the details are somewhat complicated, not very important, unless you want to do an experiment on that, in which case we can supply with all the details. The bottom line is that when you solve the Schrödinger equation with two periods, you find that this physics should show up, and you should definitely see an energy-dependent localization edge, with all states being extended or localized above or below a particular energy in a given system for fixed Vn. Now, this would be, of course, impossible to do experiments on in condensed matter system, but in principle, it should be possible to verify these predictions in suitably designed optical lattices, because the Aubry-André physics, the bichromatic physics, has already been studied in the system. Now one has to somehow create longer range hopping to do experiments on the bichromatic lattice. Now it's okay, this is a very specific model, exponential hopping. What would happen if you use something else? Here are results using Gaussian hopping. We actually have many different hopping that we studied. It's in our long paper. Again, the details are complicated, but as you see, results look very similar. What happens is that turns out that you can prove the exact theorem only for the exponential case, because only for the exponential case, this discrete Fourier transform trick works. We are just not mathematically smart enough to show it exactly for anything other than the exponential follow-up. But numerically, you can study anything, and we have studied many different implicit short-range models, and we find that it always holds, that you'll have an energy-dependent mobility edge. So it turns out it doesn't really matter what kind of model you are using. You should see this, and we think this has been experimentally seen. So now let me move on to a totally different kind of physics, where we will have no disorder, although what disorder would do to the physics I'll describe now is a very interesting question, which we have not answered in completeness. This is unpublished work of Roman Luchin, who is actually in the audience. He's now at Q. This is when he was still at JQI. So this is spontaneous interlayer Stouffer fluidity in bilayer systems of cold polar molecules. So as you know, in GILA, Junye and Debbie Jean have created a polar molecular system where the interaction is 1 over R cubed, not short range, not long range, and one can easily have, so it's not contact interaction at all, it's interaction with a range. And this kind of interaction we like very much, because as metal physicists, we are used to 1 over R interaction. So one of the things we wanted to look at was whether one can have this bilayer, interlayer coherence in this system. So what is interlayer coherence? So let's take a bilayer system, a top layer and a bottom layer, and you have particles in it. In condensed matter system, these will be electrons and holes, or electrons in both layers. The systems you have in mind now are polar molecules. So there is an interaction between them. There is no tunneling. What could happen in suitable situation, which will depend on the separation between the layers and the density of these polar molecules in here, you could have a transition where even at zero tunneling, correlation between the two layers, interlayer coherence, would spontaneously create something like tunneling. What I mean by that is that you think that if there is no single particle tunneling between these two layers, then the density of particles in one of these layers is a sharp quantum number. But when this phase transition takes place, the density of each layer just becomes an expectation value. It's no longer a sharp quantum number, only the total density is defined. Density of the individual layer is not defined. Interaction drives the system into an interlayer coherent phase. You can think of this as an interlayer superfluidity. And this it's intuitively very strange, because you have no tunneling But still, the system develops the state. So basically, you have an order parameter, which is this interlayer superfluid coherence, delta 1, 2, where the C1 dagger operator is one layer and C2 is in the other layer, and this breaks the U1 symmetry that you had in the original system. So it's a very interesting thing. This kind of the other interesting aspect of it is that I give you the language of superfluidity, but you can think of this equally well in the language of spin. So let's forget about real spin. So you're talking about spinless fermions in this system, okay? They don't have any real spin. So then you can think of each layer as a pseudo spin. Upper layer, up spin, bottom layer, down spin, because the mathematics is exactly the same. So now you have a pseudo spin system where you have spin up and spin down, and they interact. And they interact, what you can have, so you have a 2D spin problem now. You have two component spin, and you can show that this is equivalent to the Brzezinski-Costales-Thouless transition into the XY ferromagnetism. So it will spontaneously become an XY ferromagnet. That transition is exactly equivalent to this transition of spontaneous interlayer coherence. It turns out you can also think of this transition exactly equivalently as an excitonic condensation, where the electron in this system and the hole in this system bind. So one electron here binds to the hole here, creates an interlayer exciton. And those interlayer excitons, which are bosons, condense into BEC. It turns out all these three pictures are mathematically identical. It may not be obvious to you at all that they're identical, but they are. So you can, depending on what your expertise is, you can think of this as a superfluid transition, interlayer superfluidity. You can think of it as excitonic condensation transition, or you can think of it as this XY ferromagnetic transition. The language is the same, and the amazing thing is that in all, if I want to use very crude, ordinary language, I'd say that you had no tunneling in the beginning, but suddenly the system as if develops interlayer tunneling. Okay? Now you may say, this sounds like fantasy. Well, this is not fantasy. There is not an accident that we came up with the idea working on this. In quantum Hall system, this has been seen, and the person who did the first important seminal experiments of Sweet actually abandoned condensed matter physics completely, and he's sitting in the audience, Jan Spillman, and it happens in the quantum Hall system. In bilayer quantum Hall system, this interlayer coherence, this interlayer spontaneous coherence has been seen, and what happens there is that you have nu is equal to all quantum Hall, each layer has one filled quantum Hall, and then there is no tunneling. You can make this system so that there is no tunneling. Of course, in that case, the interaction is 1 over R Coulomb interaction, and you can then have this state, which is spontaneous interlayer coherent state. And just to motivate you that this can be done, we had great difficulties with referees in this paper. Referees are AMO physicists, and it was very difficult to explain what you're talking about. Here is the experiment that it has been seen. Okay? So this is, I'm not going to discuss the details. What I'm showing you here is Jan Spillman measurement, this PRL, where when the interlayer coherence develops, you suddenly, tunneling is basically zero. Okay, as you can see, tunneling is basically zero, but suddenly the tunneling becomes very, very large. And this is the interlayer coherence, and it depends on separation between the layers and the effective interaction. So this is what we now want to see, whether something like this can be made to happen in polar molecules. Why do you want to use polar molecules? Because you need an interaction which is finite in space. Zero-range interaction is not going to give you this transition, because zero-range interaction does not see the other layer at all. Zero-range interaction would give you all kinds of interesting physics in the same layer, but not interlayer physics. So of course, polar molecules are different. Now this is where I'm on very dangerous ground. All of the world leading experts on polar molecules are sitting here, and I know very little, but the postdocs are here, so they will defend me. So in polar molecule, as far as I'm concerned, the basic interaction is 1 over R cubed. It's actually extremely complex. When I say just 1 over R cubed, I'm simplifying it enormously. But for the purpose of my interest, it's 1 over R cubed. Meaning the real interaction is much more complicated. There is a core where the interaction is something, then as you go out, interaction changes, and all those things have to be taken into account. In our numerical calculation, we do take all those things into account to the extent it's possible, but the part of the physics that is important for giving us the interlayer superfluidity is this 1 over R cube interaction. And this one can control the sign of this interaction. You can make it attractive or repulsive. And what we're interested in is the repulsive interaction. So you're going to get this beautiful physics of interlayer coherence when the polar molecules repel each other. You know, when you have attractive interaction, you get superfluidity and things like that. That's interesting, but not that amazing. Here you have repulsive interaction and you get superfluidity. Now, if that bothers you, you say, how can you have repulsive interaction and superfluidity? you can then think of it as ferromagnetism. After all, for magnetism you do not need attractive interaction. Exchange physics gives you kind of an effective thing which is like an attraction. So fact of the matter is that when you have fermions, the difference between attraction and repulsion is, you know, purely apparent. It's not very important. So the way you control it is by using external electromagnetic field, where you can basically control the orientation of the dipoles, and that will control the interaction itself, and that's what we use in our calculation also, and these are all taken from real molecular physics. And so then you have an effective dipolar interaction in this AC electromagnetic field, and the dipolar interaction, as I said, it's incorrect to say just 1 over R cubed. The real interaction is more complicated, but fortunately it's known. Others have already worked out what it is, and we just use that to do our calculation. It introduces a new length scale. A new length scale appears because of the interaction. So let me now show you the phase diagram. So this is our Hamiltonian. This is the effective interaction between the layers. And I will not talk about the intra-layer part of what happens within the layer. That certainly is interesting. You can ask me about that when I end, because that will take us too far. So now we basically do a mean field calculation, a Hartree-Fock calculation, to see whether there is a symmetry breaking or not. And this is the, you know, standard Nambu-Eliash-Buck type calculation to see whether you have a U1 symmetry breaking or superfluidity or not. And this is the phase diagram. So I'm showing you the same phase diagram by calculating two different quantities. This is directly the coherence, and this is the energy difference. And they give basically the same phase diagram, and the phase diagram is being plotted as a function of physical parameters. So you have the separation between the layers in units of KF along here, and you have RS parameter, which can be defined. RS parameter is just the effective interaction that you have in the system. Large RS means weak interaction, small RS means strong interaction. It's RS is defined here in terms of this D effective and density. So these are very standard way of dimensionalizing polar molecule interaction. So what you basically see is that there should be a phase transition from normal state to superfluid state. It's a, you know, true phase transition in a regime of parameter space which is accessible. Okay, it's not in an absurd regime of parameter space. Of course, in real systems you have many other problems, and without experiment one doesn't know whether it will actually take place or not. But as a matter of principle, this certainly should exist. There is no reason for it not to exist as a matter of principle, and this will be this interlayer. And you know, in one experiment you'll see interlayer superfluidity, interlayer excitonic condensation, and XY ferromagnet BKT transition in one experiment. So if we use now magnetism language, you know, it's the same kind of phase diagram, exactly the same kind of phase diagram. There's some details I'm not going to, now we are showing you in terms of D-effective, in terms of D-bi. These are all in our, not all the results are in our papers, but if anybody is interested, we have many more results than what we have in our paper. We can give you that. And again, as I said, the numerical work actually uses the real effective interaction. So in principle, you should be able to see BKT transition. You know, seeing BKT transition is always actually tricky, but in principle, the spin stiffness, we can calculate the spin stiffness within linear response theory, and we know where the Costa-Lizarra transition would be. And again, if you look at the numbers, you know, you should be able to see the finite temperature transition also. I mean, before I was talking about a quantum phase transition, where you have this U1 symmetry breaking system goes from being an interlayer normal fluid to an interlayer superfluid, and now I'm talking about a finite temperature transition, where finite temperature drives the system from this XY ferromagnet or superfluid, interlayer superfluid, to normal fluid. And as you can see, again, these are not easy numbers to achieve, but they are not absurd absolutely. Okay, again, to the extent one can tell. Bill, how am I doing with time? I'm good. So now I'm going to talk about bosons in disorder. This is a classic problem, and there will be really, really two divorce talks later in the session where the problem is just exactly solved numerically. Okay, no question asked and it's done. What we wanted to do is to try to understand it within a very simple model. So now, before I showed you two cases, one case, quantum particle in non-interacting disorder or non-interacting commensurate potential, another one, quantum particles in bosons in particular, which are interacting between two layers. Now I want to talk about a situation where we have both disorder and interaction. So I want to understand the interacting disordered boson problem, which sometimes is called Darty boson problem, sometimes called Bose-Glass problem. It's a subject, as I said, goes back to Matthew Fisher's classic paper of 1989-90. So this is Chi Zhao's work, and actually we just posted another paper last night, we just showed up, but I will not talk about this. This is higher band physics in the same system. So let me just motivate it a little bit, since many of the original protagonists are in the audience. So if you have interaction disorder, what happens? Well, non-interacting case, we know. If the disorder is strong enough, you get localization. In the presence of interaction, the problem is much more difficult if you have disorder also. Okay, so here is the Hamiltonian. This is the famous paper of Matthew that I was alluding to. We have the kinetic energy, you have the interaction, and you have some kind of disorder. And using renormalization group argument, another theoretical argument, this paper speculated on various possible phase diagrams. Now, I should mention, often this paper of Matthew Fisher is cited in the context of Bose-Hubbard model. This is one of the most cited papers in this subject. But if you actually go back and look at this paper, you'll find the pristine Bose-Hubbard model is like half a page or three quarters of a page in this paper. You know, it's a 25-page paper. The other 24.25 pages are actually really on the question of what happens and these are interactions playing with each other. Okay, it's a very important problem. And in those days, it was important in the context of helium in Vicor. When you put helium in a very porous material, what happens? In the condensed matter context, I would say this problem is still being debated by people. So many questions. I'm going to list all the questions, and I think that we will provide some understanding of the answers to this question. For example, one question is that, can there be a direct transition from the Mott insulator to superfluid in the presence of disorder? In the absence of disorder, we know that happens. Is that true in the disordered case also? This has been debated for years. So now there are these papers, and I think there'll be, I think Prokofiev is talking, right? And I don't know if he'll be talking about this topic or not. So people have done now, basically the UMass groups in collaboration with various people have done huge exact calculations, okay? So one can say that in principle, this problem is solved. Okay, so this is kind of the phase diagram, as a function of interaction and the gap. And you have the superfluid phase, you have the Mott insulator phase, you have the Bose-Glass phase, and you can see this is a complicated phase diagram. Okay, it's not trivial to understand all aspects of it, but we are not going to try to compete with this group. What we are asking is that there are many striking features in this phase diagram. To what extent can we understand them? And for example, what are some of the questions one can ask? Well, we can ask the question why is it, look at this over here. Here, I'm increasing disorder. This is the disorder axis, and this is the interaction axis. So I'm increasing disorder here as I go for some fixed interaction. So I'm increasing disorder. It seems that at first the condensate fraction goes up because it's becoming, originally it was not a superfluid, but then it becomes a superfluid. Eventually, of course, it leaves the superfluid phase when you make the disorder very, very strong. So how come that in a limited range of parameters, increasing disorder is enhancing superfluidity? Okay, that's what the numerical results is giving. Okay, so this is a well-defined question. So it seems counterintuitive. Another question one could ask, what happens when you increase interaction at constant disorder? So you're going along this line, okay, horizontally. So your disorder is strong, you're now increasing interaction. So if you have strong constant disorder, you're increasing interaction. So what is happening here, as you can see again, here, interaction is also enhancing your superfluid density at first. Then again, when the interaction is very, very strong, you're going to go into some other phase. This also seems counterintuitive, but this is what is coming out of the exact numerical work. Then there are these Fingal and Wiggle features. What about this and what about this? It looks like there are non-trivial features, non-trivial topology of the phase diagram. Can you understand them somehow? One can also ask, what about temperature? So, what is the origin of this non-trivial topology wiggle of the phase diagram? Why does the topology of the phase diagram, how does the topology of the phase diagram actually change as a function of temperature? Why does that happen? I actually will not address these two questions. They are in our paper, but there's a good reason why I will not address it. I anticipated that I'll be running out of time. So I'll answer the first two questions, but they're all in the paper. So What we developed is a minimal model, which we think captures this interaction, interplay of interaction and disorder, and also finite temperature, although I'll not talk about it. The nice thing about this simple model is that it's exactly solvable. If we have to do numerical work in this simple model, it's worthless, because the numerical work of the full model is already done. And one can easily compute, just by direct diagonalization, what one needs. And we think it reveals physics. So the model is n bosons in a double well, and we call the double well disordered. So just two wells, and we'll put n bosons in these two wells. Now, what do I mean by disorder in two wells? So what we're going to say is that there is an energy difference between these two wells, let's say epsilon, and this epsilon is a random number. So epsilon is distributed delta and minus delta. The model is very simple, and you know, when Chizal came up with this model and told me that he wants to look at it, I was sure somebody has worked it out. I mean, this is a very, very old problem, 20-year-old problem, but apparently nobody has looked at it, which is good for us. And this is the model we solved. In case I did not get to tell you everything that we have done, we just solved this problem exactly and then phase coherence between the two models. Again, this model doesn't have long-range order, obviously, because they're just two wells. But we can define a phase coherence, because we have a left well and a right well, and this is exactly the same as what I had in my last talk when I was talking about interlayer coherence. It's a very similar quantity you're looking at here, but in this case, of course, you have hopping also. And then we're going to just study this phase coherence. So first, you have to solve the problem in a clean double well, so without any disorder. So within a disorder, you can just exactly diagonalize the problem, and then you find that what you get is that it's just a two-site model. You can calculate the expectation value of this, what we are calling phase coherence. Again, there is no long-range order here, but you can show that it falls off in some manner. Of course, it's crossover. There is no phase transition here. I have just two worlds. As you increase the interaction, okay? If you had a lattice model, then this would get converted into a true phase transition, and as you go to infinity, you have a true phase transition because of long-range order. So this is the kind of picture you have to keep in mind, that this sort of result for the true phase transition and infinite lattice will get converted into crossover in our simple toy model with two well and disorder defined as this random site energy difference. Okay, so what this is showing you, that interaction suppresses phase coherence, something we already know. This is, we know for large interaction you get more insulator, for weak interaction you get superfluid. So now we want to do the exact diagonalization in the presence of this epsilon. Again, let me not give you the details, because the details are very difficult to follow unless you are actually working on it. So you have to just accept my word that the calculations are done correctly. So now let me just see what happens when you have disorder and no interaction first. So if you have disorder and no interaction, this thing that I'm calling phase coherence just drops to zero very fast. So remember, measure of disorder is epsilon, because that's the energy difference between the two sides of the random quantity. So in the absence of interaction, you very fast lose phase coherence, which is exactly what you'd expect. Because what is this? Epsilon zero, you have very nice hopping back and forth, that's your coherence. When epsilon is much, much larger than t, you're not going to have that. Okay, it's going to be suppressed very strongly. So it's not surprising at all that it's falling off exponentially. And when you do ensemble averaging and do the calculation correctly, you find that it's monotonically decreasing very fast, and then you have a tail. Now what happens when you have, so this is, we are looking at here. So what happens when you have, So what happens, how can disorder enhance phase coherence? Now let's do the same thing in the presence of interaction. So what would happen in the presence of interaction? In the presence of interaction, you'll have all these resonances at various values of epsilon, because interaction will connect various parts of the Hilbert space, and you have, for a two-level problem, you can actually work out the arithmetic. And you find that you have all these resonance features, you have all these resonances, because if E1 is equal to epsilon and E2 is equal to U will be connected by epsilon plus U, and those resonances show up in the actual calculation. Now, when you take into account these resonances and do the calculation in the presence of interaction also, the result you get should be coming up here. So now, as we increase disorder, this is the increase of disorder at a finite interaction, it's going down, but it's not going down as fast as it was before. And in fact, if you do ensemble averaging, because of this resonance features, it actually falls up much, much more slowly. Okay, and this is not surprising at all, because what interaction is doing, interaction is in some sense smoothening your disorder. Interaction in some sense smoothening your disorder, and this smoothening at large interaction resonance feature remains even after ensemble averaging. And in fact, these resonance features show up as those wiggles or fingers, but I'm not going to discuss that. So basically what happens, let me just skip one slide since time is, disorder basically enhances now phase coherence in the presence of interaction. So essentially what happens is that two negatives, either disorder or interaction, by itself is bad, but when you put them together, in some sense, two negatives make a positive. Interaction smoothens the disorder potential, thus reducing the effect of disorder in some sense. So here is a situation for zero interaction. Here is a situation for zero disorder. When you include interaction disorder by itself, always suppresses phase coherence. But then when you take into account the effect of disorder in the presence of interaction, this resonance comes in. And similarly, when you take into account the effect of finite disorder in the presence of interaction, it falls off very slowly. So in some sense, this phase diagram, which is exactly calculated for bosonic system 1 can by Monte Carlo calculation, can be understood on the basis of a very simple model, a two-site model where disorder is mimicked by the site energy difference, a random site energy difference, and you have interaction, and phase coherence is just the tunneling between the two sites. It's not obvious at all that all the aspects of the numerical could be captured in the simple model, but I think it does. I have 3 minutes, and so this I cannot describe. There is a reason I left it for the last, because if I started with this, this would have taken all 50 minutes. So you have to read this 27-page paper if you want to learn about it, okay? So this is Stephen Powell's work. This is the physics of incommensurate vortex lattice. So this is the problem of superfluidity on a lattice in the presence of a magnetic field which is incommensurate to the lattice. So this kind of system you can create by this artificial gauge potential. So it's the Hofstadter problem. It's a very old problem in condensed matter physics, that if you have a lattice and if apply a magnetic field perpendicular to the lattice, so in general the magnetic field, the magnetic length, of course, in general will be incommensurate with the lattice, then you get this fractal structure called Hofstadter structure in the energy spectrum. Okay? Assuming it's a perfect lattice, no disorder and so on. Very old problem, and the density of state shows this fractal structure. Question is, can we create this for the bosonic cold atom optical lattices where you have superfluidity? What would happen? So I'm just going to motivate you and just show the final results. Stephen Powell, with help from Rajiv Sancham and Ryan Barnett, did a really beautiful job. My role here was minimal, so I can praise the work. So this is the phase diagram. This is flux part plaquette. So when this is very, very small, you are talking about a continuum quantum Hall, and this is lattice quantum Hall. So this is the quantum Hall one is used to when this is very large and this is particle per site. So these two dimensionless quantity define your whole phase diagram. So this is kind of filling factor and this is particle per site. When that's very, very large, you go to the lattice quantum Hall, Mott insulator, various unconfined superfluid. This is vortex lattice deep here. This is continuous quantum Hall. This is Hofstadter butterfly. We want to look in the superfluid phase what happens. So Bill just gave me a warning 1 minute. And doing battle with Bill Phillips is very difficult. So let me just tell you that this problem can be solved beyond mean field. It was already done by mean field by doing Bogolubov theory. Okay. And in Bogolubov theory, you can actually include the next order interaction corrections. It's a complete analytic calculation. Remember, there's a special symmetry breaking because of this magnetic flux, which is incommensurate. And let me just show the result. With this symplectic transformation, the problem can be solved exactly. And essentially what you get out of this quasi-particle spectrum, we have a PRL and you have this very long FISREV, very long paper in the archive, which my time has run out, which I will not discuss. I'll just show you the results. Here is the symmetry breaking pattern, the ground state, how it goes. Here is the quasi-particle spectrum. It's very complex because you have many, many, many modes. There is a Goldstone mode, but there are many other modes because of symmetry breaking. But we believe that all of this can be seen. This structure can be seen if this system can be made rather easily. And so this is how the superfluidity disappears. This is a depletion. And we calculated how the superfluidity is disappearing. And this gives us an estimate of Mott transition, which is not that different from what Gutzwiller Minfield gives. So everything seems to be consistent with each other. And you can do basically Bragg spectroscopy to pick up this frequency shift, and this frequency shift tells you that that you are seeing the correct quasi-particle dispersion. For the details, you have to go to our paper. So Let me just tell you, since I rushed through this one, just told you the highlights. What one is talking about here is a very important question in condensed matter physics, where Hofstadter and quantum Hall physics, you know, are coming within reach of atomic experiments. You know, many people, including Jan Spillman at Maryland, has already created the artificial gauge potential. Now one has to connect that with an optical lattice with superfluidity in it. Then you can actually start doing experiments to test these things, that what happens when you have an incoming suited vortex lattice deep into the superfluid phase. And our prediction for experimental probe is that you'll see the spatial symmetry breaking directly in time of flight measurements. So I think Bill Phillips is not unhappy. I'm done. I don't have an overall conclusion because, you know, I wanted to make everybody in my group happy, so I talked about many things.
Okay, well, there's so many questions. Let's start all the way over here with Emmanuel.
Emmanuel.
Let the experimentalists have at him first.
So I have a simple-minded experimentalist question on this issue of the dirty boson problem. So somehow it seems to me, so if I look at a homogeneous lattice and I start on an insulator, I think so.
That is it.
And let's say we have a super lattice, so not no disorder, but kind of the effect I will describe is, I think, reminiscent to what you describe in the disorder. So you have a super lattice and you raise every second side by a delta, for example. And of course, when you hit delta equals to U, then the system will resonantly turn superfluid.
Right.
And when you go delta beyond U, you again turn more insulating.
Correct.
And somehow it seems that everything you described in this problem, this dome around delta being U, is exactly reminiscent to this effect, resonant effect.
I think it's a bit broadened out in the disorder. I would not disagree with
exactly the same physics.
What your intuition is telling you, I would say what your intuition, what you already knew through this intuitive understanding of the system, is what we formalized by using a two-site model, showing that that exactly works out exactly the way you described it. Yeah. So again, I do not want to claim that there is anything radically new. The phase diagram is exactly known. What you're saying, you're providing an understanding, and the understanding is exactly what you said, but you have formalized it. It's not just word, and it actually works exactly that way. And all features of this complicated phase diagram out of it, that's the interesting thing, okay, quantitatively. Yeah, so I agree with you. I mean, if Chi Zhao has a separate comment, he's there, but I think I have no disagreement with what Emmanuel said.
Chi, do you have another comment? Okay.
Well, it's more a comment than a question about the localization, Anderson or Aubrey localization. You made a first statement that there is no energy mobility edge.
And then
you made a statement contradicting your first statement. And on Wednesday morning, I am also going to contradict this statement. It's just to encourage people to wake up early on Wednesday morning.
I will
gently disagree with you.
But I did not explain things very well. In the Aubrey model, there is no energy-dependent local energy. That's just a statement of fact. Aubrey model is a mathematical model, and a self-dual point, there is no. Then what I said, that if you try to make Aubrey model in a real lattice, there is always energy dependence, because But I was talking about pure mathematics. So what I said in the Aubrey model, there is no energy-dependent mobility edge, period. Aubrey model is not something in physical reality. Aubrey model is a mathematical equation. But then I said, in real experiment, the best you can do is two aperiodic potential. If you do that, I showed you results, then you have energy-dependent mobility edge. And then I said, how can I understand that? So you and I have no disagreement. We are not contradicting anything. Of course, to be dramatic, I set up something that I'm going to contradict afterwards. Dramatic square. Yes, I agree with you 100%.
Yes, well, in fact, I have questions about exactly this thing. So,
okay.
But perhaps in the interest of getting to some others, we'll leave that for Wednesday. But I think that there are some very interesting questions there about correlation lengths, which hasn't yet been...
Since you didn't ask the question, but you paraphrased the question, I have to answer. I did not show you all those things. Since we have an exact solution, for our problem, of course, you have all those things. Only problem is that in reality, you know, it's a Schrodinger equation, the potentials are not exactly known. To what extent theory and experiment will agree, I do not know. But in our problem, we have exactly solved the problem. So we have everything that you want. No, I just showed you inverse participation ratio, but we have everything. Okay, so it will be very interesting to compare with experiments those features, which you have not done yet.
Okay.
I would like to contradict the statement that model hasn't been solved before for the tilted double well. I have a paper in 07 that treats it pretty thoroughly.
With disorder?
Well, disorder for you means that you have tilt or bias in your problem.
No. Disorder is a random variable.
Yeah, I understand. We didn't randomize over that. But
so that's the whole point.
Okay, I didn't understand.
But that's the whole point.
What you were saying.
If you don't randomize it, then it's a trivial problem. I do not exactly know what you solved in 2007.
Okay, well, to make
it's an undergraduate quantum mechanics problem, then, if you do not randomize it.
Uh-huh. Okay. And so can you go back to your figure where you have this oscillation?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, this thing takes so long to go somewhere.
Yeah, it's a few more slides. Can you explain how you set up the average or the disorder to get the oscillation?
I do not know the details, Chi. You'll have to answer exactly how you did the averaging.
Okay.
Right over there, according to that equation. So the ensemble average, the value is actually the integration of the value of the coherence at a fixed mismatch between the energy numbers, just according to that one.
I'm sorry, I don't understand. Exactly what range do you think the average is flat?
It's a flat one. It's a flat one. Yes.
So if I've understood correctly, the difference between your work on this problem and the previous work was a matter of taking an ensemble average over a number of different tilted.
Right. Because what you're trying to understand is what disorder does to the phase diagram.
Yeah. So it's still a single well, but then you
two
wells. Just
two wells.
A single
double
well.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
A single pair of wells.
A single double well.
A single pair, right? Yeah. And then just averaged over the tilt.
I have a comment rather than a question about the first part about the Aubrey and Anderson
Aubrey one?
Problem.
Yeah.
Yes.
Let me see if I
so
can.
So the next neighbor hopping is not impossible, of course, to achieve.
Right.
But it's not so easy also in this experiment.
This
I just wanted to point out the similar spirit that Peter Zoller was talking in the morning.
Yes.
That there are ion systems that are being now studied, in particular the arrays of ions in microtraps.
Yes.
Or simply ions in the trap, in which, in fact, you get as an effective Hamiltonian something which not only has 1 over R3 density-density interactions, but also 1 over R3 tunnelings.
Correct.
So this is even stronger in the sense that your exponential or Gaussian, there probably these effects will be, putting disorder in those models should be easy.
Thank you very much, Masek.
There is, to make an advertisement, there will be probably post-deadline poster about this kind of models by our student Philip Hauck. It's a joint work with Ignacio Siraz.
Thank you very much. I have not thought about ion traps, although I have a colleague, Chris Monroe, who does experiments like that. Only thing I should mention is that this thing works for algebraic falloff also, as you show in our paper. But the Paul cube is at the borderline. It's higher than cube is better. So this is very good, and I agree with you completely. Maybe that's a better system to think about it, or at least that is certainly a good system to think about it, which you have not done. So I thank you.
Yes, here. For your problem of the bilayer in the polar molecules, there is something I don't understand, because if I see the wave function that you are employing there, the relative number of particles is not conserved.
That's correct.
And it seems to me that this is a constraint that the wave function has to fulfill,
and it does.
And therefore I don't understand the functions. So there is a wave function later on in a,
it does, because U1 symmetry is explicitly broken, so it does not as I said, it's not sharp. You have to tell me which particular, because that was a wave function also written
next,
in terms.
Next
okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes, did you have a wave function there?
Next one.
I think next one.
This is the, this is the gap function. This is not the wave function.
The next slide. There.
Yeah.
This wave function does not preserve the number of particles per layer.
Why do you say that?
Because you have C dagger.
No, but there is a spontaneous symmetry breaking, right? Just like in, this is essentially the superconducting ground state.
But of course, if you minimize the energy without any constraint, then you will get this one. But you have to impose the constraint.
No, but this is, we should discuss that in private. What you're talking about is that if you do Leggett type thing, the number conserving thing, are you going to get it? I'm pretty sure we will. I'm not understanding your technical objection exactly.
No, I'm saying that you have N1 particles and N2 particles. This one does not preserve. Does not have this one. That over there has. No. That over there not. And because if
yeah, this is the normal state, and this is the symmetry broken state. And the symmetry broken state would not conserve it. That's the whole point. All right, let's talk about it offline, okay? Because we are having a language problem here. This is precisely the point, that the symmetry breaking breaks exactly this symmetry, the relative number. So I'm not quite following what you are saying, but we have to discuss this. It seems that you do have a point. Let's discuss this afterwards, okay? That's precisely the point, that the normal state preserves that symmetry and this state doesn't. That's precisely the point. That's spontaneous symmetry breaking is what you're claiming.
If I can just clarify, his question is basically that you can look at superfluidity or symmetry breaking either by relaxing the number constraint or by keeping the number constraint. And this point is, when you have the number constraint, which you do because you don't allow tunneling, this is not the correct wave function.
Right. So the question is that if we change the constraint, if you do it the way Leggett does everything, would the symmetry breaking still be there? I'm absolutely confident it will be, but we have to discuss it, because I do not quite understand why that would be a problem. To me, it doesn't seem to be a problem at all. But let's discuss it. Okay.
So if I understand what you're saying is that it's it might have been formally...
Think of it this way. No, it's a very simple thing. That's the whole point of symmetry. You have to think of a very infinitesimal tunneling. I mean, I'm not even understanding what you're talking about. You always have infinitesimal tunneling. Yeah, you have. So what you have? Maybe I'm not understanding. You always construct things. Now I understand the question. Now I understand the question. So now I think I'm understanding the question. Okay. So you have to assume there is infinitesimal tunneling, and you're taking the limit of tunneling going to zero at the end. This is the way these things are always constructed. Correct. Correct. No. This is different. Yeah, this is really has become a semantic discussion, I'm afraid, okay? Because I mean, you should certainly discuss it, but I think there is a unique answer to your question. Once you understand each other's language, we'll be able to answer it. Because what you do, you construct a theory imagining there is an infinitesimal tunneling, and then you ask the question, what happens when tunneling goes to zero? This is a standard way of doing these theories, which is what we have done, and maybe that's not understanding what you're saying. But it should be discussed.
Well, I'll let Nandini make one more comment, but it seems to me that many times one gets the right answer even though one makes the wrong assumptions.
But this is not one of those times. This case we're getting the right answer and the right assumption.
And I'm not so sure.
I just had to add, this is not one of those times.
Okay.
Oh, it's the right answer within our approximation. The experiment may still not see it. That's a different question. Within our mean field approximation.
So Shankar, I agree with you. You will get the same result, right. But just the way you look at it, it can be very simply just stated in the following way. Suppose I have a ferromagnet.
Yeah.
I can look at it in the SZ equal to zero sector, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that would be the equivalent of a wave function where the number
is. If that helps you, sure.
Concept, yeah.
If that helps you, that's
and
exactly what you're doing.
What you're writing
doing.
Down is yeah. more like the SZ
sure.
equal to a maximal
yeah.
sector.
Yeah. I completely agree with you.
Yeah. I'm thinking about the sort of thing where you can get a Bose condensate with a fixed number of atoms, and then you believe that you've got spontaneous symmetry breaking, which produces a phase, which would imply there isn't a fixed number of atoms, but it doesn't change any of the physics. And I'm mm-hmm. thinking that probably this mm-hmm. has to do with that sort of thing.
That's what I said. That's what Leggett always wants, you know.
I have not quite understood if a disorder is really crucial to have this resonance phenomenon, or if you can have it also by considering as a function of the tilting in the simple double well problem.
Random tilting? Or?
Yeah. No. My question is: random tilting is crucial to have this resonance, or? If you, for instance, take interaction constant and change the tilting, not in a random way, okay. You also can see kind of
resonance. For resonance, all you need is the interaction. As was commented by one of the persons before, for resonance, all you need is interaction, and the disorder doesn't play any role there. Okay, none whatsoever. You'll have resonance. But what disorder, in the presence of disorder and resonance together, lets you understand the phase diagram. Okay, so you do not need disorder to see the resonance.
Well, no, you have to wait for the microphone, otherwise it won't be part of the permanent record.
I'll be careful what I say. So I just want to understand this point, and that's why I asked about role of disorder and the double well. And if I offended you by bringing my paper, that it was not about putting my foot on something. It was trying to understand this issue. Okay. So if I just take a double well and I tilt it, right? There's a series of resonances, tunneling resonances, correct, that happen because of interaction.
Correct.
Is that what you're seeing? And you're somehow just washing it out with this average, or are you seeing something else?
No, it's closely connected to that. It is closely connected to that.
Okay, so these are tunneling resonances, and they are being washed out by the resonances by disorder. Is that right?
You want to call them tunneling resonances, but they're in the presence of this interaction U. Okay.
That's what I mean by tunneling resonance. The interaction takes one side, moves it up, and so you get additional resonances due to interaction.
So yeah, it's some kind of resonant tunneling where interaction is included. Yeah, that's what it is. That's absolutely what it is.
So I'm not convinced that this has to do with disorder, except for possibly the broadening of the resonances, and that may be
that's what you're saying. That's what we're emphasizing, absolutely.
Okay,
yes.
So you would still see these wiggles from the picture,
correct,
but they would just be narrower.
Correct. I have a great disadvantage because I don't know your paper. It may very well be everything you're talking about is in your paper, but I cannot really say anything about
it. Well, I didn't do this average.
No, yeah. So all I'm saying is that what you're describing is what we do. Okay?
Okay.
And so this averaging thing is very important, of course, because without averaging, you don't have disorder. You just have a fixed number.
Okay. Now, one thing that happens is when you tilt, you'll find these resonances get start out extremely narrow, and then they're self-similar. They get broader and broader and broader, you know, as you tilt more and more. Okay? And this is because of Bose stimulation. You have more atoms that can go back and forth. In your case, it looks to me like all the resonances are about the same width, according to your picture. Is that right?
This I cannot tell you. I'm not understanding
the question. It looks...
No.
It's not, but it's close. They're not different by orders magnitude.
Yeah. That I think will depend on the model. You know, I'm not sure. I do not think that... I mean, it's an exact diagonalization. Whatever you see is what the results are.
Okay. So I just one last thing, which is to say, I'd be very interested to know if this improves that situation, because that's one of the things that prevents the possibility of realizing cat states. It's really very important to have these broader resonances. So if you can do that with disorder, could also help for creating noon states. Yeah.
So I think we're going to have to cut the discussion off in favor of lunch, and I suggest that these discussions continue during lunch. Let's thank Shankar again. Now, Vincent, do you have any instructions for us?